Marcus Hoffman, thanks for joining us on this talk about the upcoming presidential elections for the EHF.
Thank you for having me.
Can you start by telling us a little bit about Marcus Hoffman? Who is he? What's his personal life? What's his hockey history? Professional life? Who is Marcus Hoffman?
Okay, first and foremost, I'm a hockey player. And a hockey nerd and a hockey connoisseur, I tend to think. I remember very clearly when I got hooked into this sport. I mean, I started to play a little bit, and then someday, that was back in the early 80s, Pakistan was touring Europe and they played a game here in Spain at the Polo Club, and my father took me there. And then I saw a guy called Hassan Sardar, and I said, oh, this is different. I want to do this. And then I started to practice like a possessed. And I had some success early on when I was young. And then at the age of 24, I left playing. I didn't make the national team. And I had the opportunity to work in investment banking. And I moved to New York to start my banking career. Yeah. That lasted until 2009, something like that. And then I sent my father into retirement and I'm managing the assets and the companies in my family now.
The family business.
So basically, I invest capital and I move capital around. And I manage CEOs, which is sometimes the hardest thing to do.
Yeah, those are stubborn people.
Yeah, and then in terms of hockey, when I came back when I settled in back in Barcelona, I really wanted to start a coaching career, but I was thrown very quickly into management and administration. Basically, my business background was helping there. And so I started with the club at the Catalan Hockey Federation. I helped Leandro Negre with his campaign in 2008 and strategized a little bit behind the curtains in his early years at the FIH. And then like 2.5 years ago, maybe around the first elections between Marc Coudron and Batra, I said to myself, now, I don't like what I'm seeing, so I have to step up. I mean, my attitude in life is like, instead of complaining, you just don't try and fix it.
Yeah, then do it yourself instead of complaining.
Yeah, I call it the bar attitude. So you see a target, say, they hold my beer, and then you go.
There we go. They're perfect. Perfect. Okay, cool. Good warm up. So let's finish our warm up before we start the real game with the real questions. Let's do a quick lightning round. So I'm going to ask you a couple of questions and you answer immediately, just one name, one sentence, very short, and immediately following that. So that we get really warmed up then.
One name.
First, okay. Yeah. First thing, best goalie.
Ramon Jufresa in the 90s, that he played with Spain in the 90s.
Okay.
2000s.
That's a surprising one to start with already. Best midfielder?
I should say Tönde Neuer, but he's, I mean, the GOAT and he's above everybody. I would say Bjørn Emmerling.
Ah, okay. Yeah, also good choice. Best striker?
Stefan Blöcher or Hasan Sardar.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, I'm not here. I will not say, I mean, Tönde Neuer and Dihan Chand in the 30s, back in the 30s, the Indian player, are above everything. So of the mortal players, Stefan Blöcher, Hasan Sardar.
Okay, there we go.
From Pakistan, not the Indian one. The Pakistani.
The Pakistani, I understood from the previous one. Best team
best
that
team
you ever saw play?
That I ever saw playing, probably Club Leven, Uhlenhorst, Mülheim in the 90s, and national team, I would say Germany in 92, probably was the most compact player. There have been others, but I did really like that German team.
Top. Best umpire?
Okay, in history, Santiago Deo, that's undeniable. He was the most influential umpire ever, and with his cigar and so on. Right now, and maybe I shouldn't say that. No, Sarah Wilson. Men or women, Sarah Wilson.
Yeah, cool. best tournament that you watched or witnessed or saw?
Oh, Champions Trophy 1997.
Okay.
In Amstelveen. Takovan and Horner at his best.
Ah, yeah. Yep, yep.
Blücher, everybody.
Ah, cool one. What's the best rule in today's modern hockey?
The best rule? Wow, that's a good question. A very good question, my friend. I would say that the most definitive rule in hockey is that you can only touch the ball on one hand, on one side of the stick. It defines the entire game. Mm-hmm. And actually, the people who knows how to dribble is poetry in motion. So I would say touching the ball with one side, only one side.
A lot of people would have said self-pass, but this is a nice one as well.
Actually, some people think that we should touch it on both sides, and I basically, mm-hmm. Lose respect for them immediately.
Yeah, absolutely. Let them go and play in Canada and America and play on ice, not on grass anymore. What's the worst rule, actually, in hockey?
Oh, okay, now I'm going to get in trouble. The worst rule, because actually I think it's an illegal thing, is the reverse edge backhand stick.
Okay.
Backhand shot. It's dangerous beyond belief. It is, and I don't understand why we are talking about changing the penalty corner and we are not paying attention to that. Uh-huh. Actually, I think it's a contradiction in the rules because you know that the shock between the stick and the ball has to absorb 2% of the power. And when you do it like this, you change the masses and the physics of the shock. And I think it should be illegal. And very dangerous. Okay, it's very spectacular at top level, but if the rules have to be for everyone, it's very dangerous.
Nah, exactly. What's the biggest threat to hockey at this moment?
The biggest threat in hockey? Well, I think it's a social dynamic of wanting information or the things that you're watching on TV to be very short, very intense, and hockey is a 1 hour game where things happening, but it's not play-by-play game, and sometimes attention of the spectators, of the new fans, can be a little bit unstable there. So if there's a need for hockey to be a more commercial game, this social dynamic goes against our game. But we can't do anything about it.
No, exactly. What's the biggest strength of hockey?
Oh, the people. Ah. The people. I mean, especially in Europe, you see how the atmosphere in the clubs, around the big tournaments, even in the national teams, and then the umpires and the officials, and even we at the board at the EHF, and you say, dude, this is a great place to be. With amazing people. People have amazing capabilities. And hockey is a sport that, if you compare it to most of the others, the people in hockey are highly educated. So that helps.
No, exactly. We talk about the hockey family, and sometimes it sounds a little bit corny, but it truly is, even globally. Yep. Yeah? Exactly. Okay, I guess we are well warmed up, and let's start talking real business now. The business of EHF and governing hockey. Why do we have an EHF? Why do we have a European Hockey Federation? And how does it function? And what are its core tasks, according to you?
Okay, let's just compose this one. I mean, the ultimate purpose of the European Hockey Federation is be the delegated governing body of hockey in the continent of Europe. Mm-hmm. And as it happens in governments, you have country government, and then you have the regional governments, and then you have the municipalities. So you basically serve your people. The closer you are to them, the best you can serve them, right? Mm-hmm. That's why we have a European Hockey Federation. Then we, as European Hockey Federation, I think that we provide the most highly aspirational competitions portfolio ever in the world of hockey. I mean, the European Hockey Federation organizes more international hockey events than all the other federations combined.
Wow.
So roughly this year, we have organized like 37, 38 events. If you take one Pro League week as one event, and one and the Asian Games as one event, and the Pan American Cup as one event, they organize combined. So FIH, PAF, Asia, Africa, and Oceania around 31, 32. Okay. We are topping 40. So we are the, let's say, the best international tournament organizing machine in the world of hockey. And that's something to be considered. And we're doing it with nations and with clubs, which is the biggest difference between our continent and the others. So we give as well an aspirational path for clubs as well. And then we represent the interest of the European countries and national associations in front of the FIH as the president of the EHF, as an ex officio seat at the board of the FIH. And yeah. And then we represent as well in other official, let's say, places, European Union for grants for development and things like that. And then you ask, what is exactly how we do it? I'm running the risk of oversimplifying this, but I call it the clock machine of the federation. We get money from our member associations. We get money from the International Hockey Federation as part of the Olympic pie. We hire staff. This staff, along with all the volunteers in Europe, help us to organize this amazing portfolio of competitions. Some of these competitions do not make money, some make money. And out of all these 37 competitions, we get some money, get some proceedings. Maybe, basically, they come from hosting fees, participation fees, sponsoring, and TV licensing. And we have as well some costs associated to all of that, but that basically gives us some money. We, not all this money goes to development because we have to pay some more other things at the office. We save some money for the rainy days as COVID happened, for example. And with the rest, we invest it in development, which is basically a mean of getting teams and nations to improve their performance and be able then to go to the big competitions. And that's basically what we do. And then year after year, we do this.
Cool.
Right? Yeah. In my opinion, and as I wrote in my letter, this is not enough, especially for development. I have some ideas on that, and we can discuss them afterwards. But basically, the EHF is like that. And then there are some immaterial or non, let's say, non-hard facts, which is that we, I think, and Marijke Florian was a leader in that, we are the beacon in gender equality, social inclusion. The ID competitions that we organize around Europe are a model that have been have been praised even in, you know, higher stances, and a little bit of a beacon for the rest of the world as well. But not because we think that we are better or worse. It's because I think that we are doing it good.
No, agreed. I think we are even a model for all other sports in the world when it comes to those items there. Okay, should you be elected in a little while, what are your priorities for year one if you're president? And what changes, what stays, and what would distinguish you from probably the other candidate for presidency?
Oh, that's a hard question. No. Peter is taller than I am, and he's a former umpire, and I am not. And with that, everybody can figure out. No. So first of all, that's a tricky question because I don't know if I always have talked to presidents that have, you know, started their presidency, and they always said the same. The first year, it's very frustrating because you want to do a lot of changes, but since the machine is in motion, you cannot change things. But the first challenge is to make the board a high-performance board. What I mean with that? The president does not appoint the board. The board is elected, and that basically the General Assembly gives you a board. Actually, we are changing half of the board this time around. We changed the honorary treasurer, sorry. We change one female and two male ordinary members. So that's a big change. And there are very valuable board members that will depart, like Simon Mason or Sabina Zampetti. And the first priority is to make this a good team that performs. That's the first priority of the, because when you're a president, you're as well the chair of the board, right?
Yes.
That's the first thing. The second thing, and this is part of my proposal, is that since we don't generate enough resources from our competitions, and I think that the growth of those resources is limited because hockey, I don't foresee hockey to explode like paddle is doing now, or beach volley did like 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. We are not going to explode in terms of commercial attractiveness. I think that we have to try to capture resources that right now we cannot capture them. And I mean all these social corporate social responsibility budgets that we are not taking. And there I would establish a EuroHockey Foundation and start to raise money for the purpose of development.
Okay.
Development, gender equality, ID hockey, and developing nations, especially in Eastern Europe, that need our help. Not exactly in material resources, but need our help, and we would need some more resources to help them. Mm-hmm. But even that, even if I could generate those resources, bear in mind that I could not go to, I don't know, I mean, we're in talks with Albania, and maybe in some years they can join the European Hockey Family. Well, they are part of the family, but the European Hockey Federation.
Yeah.
And if I would go there with resources, with a wand and say, bibidi bari boom, it would not make any difference. The success of the Albanian Hockey Federation, the Hungarian Hockey Federation, the Slovakian or the Slovenian or whoever, lies on their people. Yeah. The EHF can help, but they have to do it. And usually the big resources for those countries are inside their countries, in the ministries, in their national Olympic committees, and we can help them to get there. Mm-hmm. And finally, first year, I think that we should have a thorough review of the EHL. It was public knowledge that we tried to change a little bit the tone and the whole thing, the EHL, and there were rumors that we would play intra-week games and things like that. Finally, that didn't happen, but it's still pending that we have to review the EHL.
Yeah.
And if you afterward you have questions on that, we can go deeper on that.
Yeah, we'll get back to that for sure. But how can also the EHF give a voice to the club's interests? So we've seen in most European countries, the clubs at the competitive level have created other organizations next to their normal NA, their national association, because they feel that sometimes they are not really represented at the international level as a club. Because, yeah, obviously, NAs or national associations, they always have to serve two masters. They have international hockey with their national teams, and they have domestic hockey. If they have domestic hockey in some certain countries, there is no, I guess. But how do we make sure that the club has a voice when decisions are made on the international level that influence their being?
Okay, now I will try to prevent my schizophrenia from popping up, as I am board member at the EHF and our club president and pretty much involved in the foundation of the Spanish Hockey Club Association. Mm-hmm. So, okay. How do I say that? When people or organizations get together to defend their interest, to look after their interests, usually it's either to capture an opportunity or to defend from a threat. And for example, I give you the example in Spain. We were like for the last 12 years, something like that, talking about getting a club association and things like that. But we never got to do it because we couldn't capture any opportunity. There was no, you know, money to go thereafter. So there was no incentive. Mm-hmm. When the Pro League, the first version of the Pro League came along, it posed a material threat to the calendars of the national leagues and to the, I wouldn't say the very existence, but the health of the national leagues. You were playing three yeah. weeks and then 2 weeks stopped because the national team was going to New Zealand to play one and two games. That was it. And so that triggered basically that all the clubs sat and said, okay, guys, we have to unionize and start to defend our interests, right? I think that right now there have four countries, well, the four big leagues, Netherlands, Germany, Belgium, and Spain, have a hockey clubs association, and I think, and then there was created the European Hockey Clubs Association, right? And that's a new actor in the field where, as if I'm elected president, I will have to deal with that. It's basically because the European Hockey Federation was designed by national associations, and the members are the national associations. So the clubs, they don't have a say in here. Mm-hmm. But since half of our portfolio of competitions are club-based, we should start to think about how we include club in this thinking, right? Having right now already dealt with the threat of a very stretched calendar of the Pro League, and the windows where the Pro League is played are already well explained, and I think that the leagues are now more or less okay. All these clubs associations, they need to think what's next for them. Mm-hmm. And as I said to some of their leaders, I said, guys, I mean, if somebody now fixes the Pro League problem, what will be the purpose of your existence? Mm-hmm. And they have started to do other projects. They had these under 19 trophies in Eastern with the champion, with the under 18 or under 19 champions of all those countries. And that's, you know, great project. The start was okay. And now the only thing that we have to see is how we, you know, put all of this puzzle together, right? Mm-hmm. Of course, they have to acknowledge that the EHF works as it is, and that it's a club of national associations, but mm-hmm. we have to be sensitive to their existence and help them, especially because if we think that our club base is what basically differentiates Europe from the other continents.
That's the problem. Yeah.
No, it's not the problem. It's a blessing.
Well, yeah.
but especially for me, because I like to be around clubs and my kids but we have to take care of that. Yes. And we have to do it with an open mind.
Yeah. Okay. Another problem that I have a little bit with the way of thinking from an organization like the FIH is that they focus globally on the growth of followers for hockey. Contrary to the FIH, I believe that one player will create 10 followers, but I guess that you need 100,000 followers to create a player. So I believe that the purpose of a federation, whether it's a national federation or a continental or a global federation, the one major purpose of a federation is growing the number of players of your sport. So what should the EHF do to grow the number of players in all categories in the established countries? And what can they do to do the same in the countries that do not have yet a established hockey culture with clubs or other organizations that make a hockey culture go and be successful?
Yeah. Okay. Well, actually, there are two questions. The first one regarding the FIH. I mean, in the last 20 years, hockey has, you know, get more professional and has professionalized its structures in the FIH, in the EHF, and even in clubs. And most of these sport professionals, they don't come from the world of hockey. And they sometimes come from sports that are massive if you compare it to hockey. I mean, hockey is a big sport. I think it's the last big amateur sport, has been in the mm-hmm. Olympic program for more than 100 years. It's played in more than, we have 140 members at the FIH, but I think that's less than around 125 that really play. But we don't have the traction that other sports have, especially because mm-hmm. our sport is difficult to follow. I mean, mm-hmm. if, and sorry to get a little bit stuck on this one, but if you look at sports that have small balls and big fields, meaning golf, cricket, baseball, and hockey, we are the only one who is not play by play, or shot by shot, or pitch by pitch. It's dynamic. So to follow a hockey game, it's, you have to be a connoisseur, or you have to have somebody that you like seeing there. Yeah. Otherwise, it's get there. I mean, I have a lot of friends say, yeah, I like hockey, but I just get lost. And yeah, I pay attention when there's a penalty corner, because they say that it's very dangerous, a very, you know, a high probability of scoring goals. Otherwise, I just get tripped out of the game. So growing hockey is going to be by, as you said, growing players. But the FIH, I understand. I mean, I can understand that they have this feeling of how that they... that they think about growing the fan base, and they have an awkward way of counting them. I had an argument actually with an FIH staffer, and he told me, no, but we have grown fans. And I said, no, you haven't grown fans. No. You now count the existing fans in a different manner. So yes. If I sign up to the app and I subscribe to the Watch Hockey, you're now counting, oh, we have a new fan. No, mm-hmm. I have been here for the last almost 50 years. Now you have a different way of counting me, which is interesting, because then you can go to the commercial side and sell it better. But mm-hmm. We are not going to create, and sorry to the stereotype, a fat guy in Naples saying to his wife, Maria, I'm watching Pakistan against Australia here at 2 a.m. No, my father used to do that with an Argentina-Brazilian football for the America's Cup or the Copa America.
Yeah.
But in hockey, I don't see this happening. So we have to concentrate in growing the base, the bottom of the pyramid. Mm-hmm. And then the second question that you ask is how to grow players. You said in already established countries. Well, the EHF, I don't think that we have to help those countries to grow their player base. And it's nothing against them. Actually, we are blessed that they have the capabilities and the resources to grow their player base through mm-hmm. the clubs, through programs at schools, at challenging neighborhoods and things like that, as for example the KNHB is doing with the Hockey Foundation. That's not the problem. Actually, at some point I would like to ask those countries to help me to grow the players in the developing countries. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
And in the developing countries, that's complicated, because if you look, I mean, FIH approach is, let's go to the demand economics of the sport. And that is basically trying to increase commercial things and attract new people and do events with a lot of things that even non-hockey people can join and have a great time and so on. And then you have the supply economics, which basically you build a hockey pitch and then it's like that movie of Kevin Costner. You build it and they will come, right? Yeah. And I have been in countries this last month where they don't have a hockey pitch. They don't have it. They play in small football pitches.
Yeah.
So there we have a huge challenge. Some of the school programs that these NAs are doing are incredible. Mm-hmm. But let's face it. If I'm dealing with a national association, that when I ask them, how many players do you have overall in your country? And they tell me I have 200 players. I'm thinking that in my club, only the under 14 girls, I have more players than these national association. Yes. So the conversation changes completely and the challenges in front are massive. And thinking that just sending some balls and sticks, we deal with the problem. I mean, there are many buttons that we have to touch. And we have to do it actually tailor-made for each national association. That's the big challenge, because we don't have We don't have a staff of 47 people. We have 9 people at the EHF.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a difficult one because I think that, in all honesty, we have 140 nations around the world who are affiliated to the FIH. I think we have a little over 40 who are affiliated to EHF.
Yeah, 40 because Great Britain, it doesn't count because you have the other three. Israel, we can find them. Azerbaijan, they're banned for participation, and we have to see whether we, how can we bring them back. And Moldova, we don't know where the federation is because the former president was Mr. Babayan. He died, and then
nobody was there.
We don't even know. And actually, the federation is somewhere in the trans. Well, I don't know the name of this region that it's pro-Russian, and then the Olympic Committee cannot locate them.
No, so it becomes very difficult then, So, but 39, let's say 39, around the world, more or less 140. But I guess if we truly count around the world, we have some 20 or 30 nations with a large body of playing hockey, play people playing hockey. In Europe, between 10 and 15, and I think that easiness is on the higher end. Do all these countries need to go to our club model, or what are other models that they could start up and build the game?
No, there are some of them. I mean, okay, our club model, if we think about it, I close my eyes and think about a club model that we know. I think about a clubhouse with a parking lot and then some hockey pitches, and some have tennis courts and paddle courts. And in my club, we have a football pitch and some outdoor pool. That's a club, right? You pay your membership fee, and your son plays hockey, your girls as well. My wife plays paddle.
Yeah.
That's science fiction for half or more of our national associations. Mm-hmm. Science fiction. The model that would work more in these countries is a school-based model, team-based model with municipal pitches, that sort of things. I mean, to talk about club model in Serbia, it's science fiction. They don't even have one pitch.
No, agreed. So also, it touches more or less on the same topic. In most of Europe, we have a very different view on a very different idea about the purpose of sport from other regions in the world, even from other regions in Europe. So how do we prevent that the development internationally becomes just about creating national associations, get them a couple of employees, bring in a little bit of government grants, create maybe one national team, participate in one national tournament, and get a little bit of Olympic money through that, and that's it. And they don't do the school program. They don't do a club program, if that's a possibility. They don't do the real development of growing the game. So how do we prevent that it becomes all only about creating an NA and a couple of commercial possibilities?
Yeah. Well, first of all, we can't prevent it. No. The question that we should ask ourselves is that this infringe into our model, right? Mm-hmm. And maybe in the last years, we have been like trying to preach to the rest of the world that our model is the right one, and that if you don't do our model, you're, you know, just flat out of your mind. And and this, I think that we need to revisit that. Mm-hmm. I mean, actually, even myself, I'm changing my opinion because, just for you to know, I'm easily seduced by facts and good arguments, and trying to understand better the other continents and the other realities is part of what we have to do if we want to be meaningful in this hockey world. Mm-hmm. And since we can't prevent that, right? We have to ask ourselves whether we have to help them or not do what they are doing. I'll give you an example.
Okay.
My favorite national team, it was Pakistan before they changed the color of the shirt, right? Mm-hmm. I basically would ban Pakistan with this color of the shirt. I like the green.
The original green,
yeah.
Yeah.
And if you look what Pakistan is doing now, you see a sort of competition between hockey academies trying to get talent out. And so this talent gets into the national team. So you can showcase that, oh, look, this player went to the national team. And now,
because of me. Yeah.
Because of me. So, you know, you bring more kids, pay me to train them. And that's the whole business.
Yeah.
This is different of what we are doing in clubs. Mm-hmm. But that might work for Pakistan. Mm-hmm. Not working for the time being, but this is not the fault of the academies. It's mm-hmm. of the federation and how they are governing themselves. But it might work. Mm-hmm. Do we want to take part in helping them? I don't know, maybe. Mm-hmm. But what is for sure is that we should not be judgmental about how people try to develop themselves. And then you have the very struggling nations, mm-hmm. some in Africa, some in Central America. Certainly, we have as well a good number of them here in Europe. Yeah. And there, the help is more like education of coaches, helping them to structure the small competition and so on. Mm-hmm. They already have it with their continental federations, but mm-hmm. you know, there's as well this this idea that in Europe we do this better than the rest, mm-hmm. because we do it. We're very good. But that's it. Mm-hmm. It's not good, not bad. We know how to do it.
Okay. If we look at the countries a little bit in between, I'm thinking of countries like France, like Austria, like Switzerland. There is an hockey competition. There is a league. There are, in these cases, clubs. But they do not really get off the ground and have this explosive growth or even slow, steady growth. How do we change this? How do we help those countries to make next steps?
Yeah. Well, Switzerland, as you know, is my other country. I mean, I'm originally from Switzerland, though I've been raised in Spain. There are two things. First of all, let's not forget that Austria is indoor world champion. So they know how to do things. I mean,
absolutely.
Yeah. In terms of outdoor, I feel when I see players and especially club teams in those countries, there are some teams that really perform very well, but the majority of teams do not embrace high performance life as mm-hmm. the number 7 club in the Dutch league is doing.
Yes.
And if you have 12 teams in your league embracing high performance life, meaning you devote most of your life and you're
becoming better,
how you train, how you eat, how you rest, your life. Okay, you can have one or two teams performing reasonably well, but the vast majority of the league does not support that these two teams to get better and better. Right? And this mm-hmm. sometimes happens in these countries that you mentioned. And the second thing, there are numbers. I mean, if you look at Switzerland, and Switzerland, they had in the neighborhood of, or for example, Wales, 7,000 players. Mm-hmm. 7,000 players. Is it good? Yeah, it's a dream for most of VNAs. But you compare it to Germany, 83,000 players. To Belgium, almost 60,000. Well, the Netherlands, 260,000+.
Yeah.
And numbers help. Mm-hmm. The only place that it's a little bit a sort of a miracle is Spain, that with only 15,000 players, they do very well. But they have a thing that helps. It's the hockey is very much concentrated. If you take Barcelona, Terrassa, San Cugat, and then Madrid, that creates a lot of competition, internal competition that increases the level.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely.
Or Argentina, 180,000 girls play hockey.
Yeah.
You will find 18 girls really good. No, and if you train them well, exactly. As they do.
Yeah exactly. But then how do you bring, it is possible. If you look at the example of Belgium, obviously the country where I live, so I know that example really well. But 20 years ago, we were 12,000, 13,000 members. Now we are 60. Yeah. It is possible.
Yeah, but the EHF or the FIH had nothing mm-hmm. to do with that.
True.
As I told you with the case of Albania, mm-hmm. the success of Belgium lies with the Belgians,
yes,
not with the EHF.
Yeah, true.
The EHF, the only thing that can do is to have the proper portfolio of competitions mm-hmm. so that when a country or a nation or a club really excels, mm-hmm. has a reasonably quick path to win the EHL, the Euronations, or the Olympic Games. Mm-hmm. Right now, actually, with the European qualifiers, if Albania would join the EHF and would have a fantastic generation of players, better than anyone else, in 6 years or in less than 6 years, they could be Olympic champions. Depending on which year they would start. We only have to put the competition infrastructure. So if you have a great team, you can get there. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. According to FIH again, the solution to all of this is another short format called Hockey Fives. I'm known as someone who does not like Hockey Fives. I understand the need for a short format. I think we already have it with indoor hockey. We play it with six, and you can play it outdoors as well. But okay. Yeah. According to you, because EHF has not embraced Hockey Fives, but it is going with the flow of providing possibilities in fives to go to competitive events and stuff like that. So what is the added value of fives when we already have a six-a-side short format? And would you accept it replacing 11v11 at the Olympic Games? And if not, how can we prevent this from happening?
Okay. Different things here. I mean, the history of Hockey 5 was because the IOC wanted a short version for the Youth Olympics. And because, let's face it, one of the things that hockey has, it's not a problem, but it's something that is an issue, is that we have 12 or 16 teams at the Olympics, 25 people from day one until the last day of the Olympics, all in the Olympic Village, and it's more than 500, with, if you count the officials and umpires, more than 500 people there mm-hmm. the whole event. And that's expensive. And then they compare this with TV ratings and so on, and commercial value, blah, blah, blah. So for the Youth Olympic Games, they wanted a reduced version, and we provided Hockey 5, which was, okay, let's do something like indoor, but outdoor. Mm-hmm. And so the original purpose was development for youth, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Sorry. And then at some point, somebody had an idea. And they said, okay, why don't we try to boost this format? And you never know if this was coming from the Olympic Committee saying, well, why don't we try to, have a cheaper version of hockey and to do Hockey 5 in the Olympics? Look how successful we were with beach volley. And now, let's say, three-side basketball. Yeah. And I was like, oh my God, I mean, come on. I mean, Hockey 5, we just invented it. Mm-hmm. Beach volley has been played in Copacabana Beach for the last years. And three-side basketball, come on. I mean, I lived for 9 months in New York City. I know what Rooker Park is in Harlem, and they play there every single weekend. And even Kobe Bryant or Michael Jordan used to play there in the summers. And so there's a history of that format. With Hockey Five, we didn't have it. Mm-hmm. Actually, the rules are, I think they're dangerous. I think that it's the goals come from nowhere. I think that, but I can understand why they did it, right? Mm-hmm. And I respect that. To try to say, okay, let's do a Hockey 5 World Cup. Well, first of all, that triggers one thing, is that we have to have a European qualifier for that World Cup. So then the EHF gets involved. Some countries have said, no, I'm not playing Hockey 5, Belgium, Spain, Germany, I don't know, which I think it's okay. They say, okay, it basically infringes our calendar, our plans, and we are already budget. Okay with budget. I mean, at the end, budget. Yeah. But you basically, we already have our plate full with the two other formats. Mm-hmm. And today, let's face it, Hockey 5, if I would ever have a saying in that, would be development and exhibition. Mm-hmm. An exhibition, for exhibition works.
Absolutely.
I mean, what happened in the port of Lausanne last summer, I was actually in the area with my son, and okay, of course, I went there. And the atmosphere was great. I told Thierry Weil, and I say, oh, I'm pretty impressed. And afterwards, I told as well to Frank Schneider, who helped to organize, the president of the Swiss Hockey Federation, who helped to organize that. And I said, it's pretty cool. And actually, on that place, Saif Ahmed, the president of the African Hockey Federation, was saying, oh, we can get this to the pipe, to the pyramids. And actually, next February, there will be an event just right on the pyramids. That will I'm sure it will be spectacular.
Yeah,
and it can have
cool.
commercial value, will be a super show. The question is whether the governing bodies have to organize these kind of things, or we can let this to the hockey industry.
Yes.
I don't know. For example, let's go to the golf example. The governing bodies, which is the Royal and Ancient Golf Club of St. Andrews and the USGA, the United States Golf Association, they do not produce the professional events. Okay, they do the US Open and the Open Championship in Scotland and England.
Yeah.
But they don't do the PGA Tour. They don't do the Leaf Golf. There's an industry, and they are only the governing bodies.
Yeah.
But hey, everybody likes to make some money, and if they think that they can grab some money, they will try it. Or we will try it, because you never know. But I think that's development and exhibition. And never infringe, and I would not make space in the actual calendar. It's very crowded. We only have 50 weeks to play.
Yeah.
And because traditionally we don't play during Christmas. And I don't think that we should basically make space for a window for Hockey 5. If Hockey 5 is played, well, they will conflict with other formats, and I'm sure that we will find players to play that. That poses one challenge for the mid-tier countries, the Polands, the Switzerlands, and the Austrians. Because if they want to succeed at Hockey 5, and there's a Hockey 5 World Cup, and participating in this World Cup is important for them because they can get more money from their government, then they only have a set of players to play all the three formats.
Yeah.
And that's a challenge. I agree, I understand, and we should look into it case by case.
My biggest fear is that Paris might be the last Olympics where we play 11v11, and that FIH might decide that from LA on we go to five Hockey Fives. Okay. How do we, should we? Maybe we shouldn't. And as EHF or federations here in Europe, should we prevent that? And how can we?
I mean, how can we? Well, okay. The president of the EHF is an ex officio member of the FIH board. So there.
Has one vote?
It's a very complete minority. But at least let's not forget that the president of the European Hockey Federation, it can have one vote, but can have a loud voice.
Yes.
I mean, come on. let's face it, it's the president of the European Hockey Federation, and the members of this federation are Germany, world champion, Belgium, silver medal, Netherlands, bronze medal. Yeah. And if we go to the ladies, it's not the top three, but one of them. And then there are in the top 10. I mean, it's an important voice. So that would be one thing. Second, and we had a lot of conversations about the FIH elections. I think that Tayyab likes 11-side hockey and he will fight for it. Mm-hmm. And the third thing is that whatever comes in the form of, okay, guys, we don't like this format of A11 anymore. I don't know. I think that our World Cup then should be the premier event of hockey and we should stay with 11 side. If the IOC, for whatever reason, does not like hockey, I think it would be a monumental mistake on the part of the IOC. Hockey has been part of the Olympic program since, I think it was 1920.
In Antwerp?
No, it was in London.
Amsterdam?
No, it was London 08 and Antwerp 20. Yes. Which actually there was the first great player in hockey, who was Stanley Shoveler, played and won the gold medal for England or for Great Britain in 1908 and 1920. And I still don't understand why he's not at our Hall of Fame, but that's enough.
Okay.
Yeah. That's the first hero in hockey. He was a player for Westminster and Hampstead Club, I think.
Oh, wow. Wow. Well, you know your history, that's for sure.
Yeah, and I haven't been to the Hockey Museum yet.
Oh, wow. That's a must see.
No, the problem is that if I enter the Hockey Museum, I might ask for asylum there. So my wife
could Yeah, the family might object.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
No, but I would say, going back, I think that it would be a big mistake from part of the IOC. That's my opinion. And I think that after running and jumping, hitting a stone with a stick is the third thing that we humans did, even if when we were primates. Yeah.
No, absolutely.
It's part of the culture of sport, hitting something, a ball or a stone with something. And we have golf, tennis, cricket, lacrosse, hockey in different formats. It's it's part of the culture.
It is. So let's hope that the IOC come to their senses and FIH stays true to our sport here. FIH at this moment, and I think that all of us in the world would 100% agree with their idea and their concept, they're pushing for a dry turf instead of a irrigated artificial pitch like we know today. I think there's no one in the world who would say, no, we have to stay with an irrigated pitch for whatever reason. We all would like to make that move to a non-irrigated or a dry turf. However, the technology at this moment just isn't there. If we maintain the idea that we do not want to change our sport, it's very difficult within a couple of years to have a drive turf which allows hockey to be played in the way that we are used to being to playing it today. The FIH has said we want to challenge the manufacturers and has put a deadline, World Cup of 2026. And at this moment, they hold firm. That is the deadline that should be played on a dry turf, which means that by the end of 2024, we should have multiple dry turf pitches around the world that are capable of hosting competitive events. Today, technology does not look like that is feasible. When do we make a cutoff? Because 2026 is around the corner. Or we push for the dry turf. And what are then the changes to our sport that we are willing to accept to make that move to a dry turf in 2 years?
Yeah. Okay, The use of water in hockey has been an issue over the last 15
since
years.
Since ever we started using hockey.
Yep. In winter, which is a 2-minute, if you have 8 sprinklers, 2-minute program, 12,000 liters. Yeah. In summer, with 3-minute program, you go to almost 20,000 liters per water, you know.
Yeah.
Every time you water the pitch, right? And that's even if you can, you know, you reuse the water, it's basically, especially in Spain, that we had some drought conditions. Everybody is prevented to fill their swimming pools, and then they go past your club, and then you pop sprinkling water all around. Right? It doesn't look good. The technology is not there. There's a reason for that. It's like in the last 20 years, there has been a consolidation of the turf manufacturers. Mm-hmm. When AstroTurf, Polytan, Polygrass, and Deso, 20, 25 years ago, they were competing for the market. They were doing fantastic and phenomenal pitches. You don't find today polyamide based pitches like AstroTurf System 5000 of 2002. Mm-hmm. You don't find that. Mm-hmm. That was the best pitch ever produced, but they moved to polyester and polyethylene. It's because it's cheaper.
Yes.
And but you know, we adapted, and that's the end of it. If we change to dry pitches, yes, there will be changes in the way we play. And because sliding is out of the question.
Yes.
I mean, there's the dry, the water pitch, what it makes is that the shoe sticks more or less to the ground, but your skin slides. And that's, you know, that's nirvana. That's, you know, what we all want. That's a Christmas list. If we go for the dry pitches and they make it that the shoes stick, but not too much, your skin will be burned if you slide. As we were doing when the sand-based pitches that in my generation, we all have our knees, like, with a lot of marks that we play hockey, right? And our fingers, especially on the left fingers.
Yes.
Will we change the way we play? Yes. In a conversation with Michel Keenan, our head of coaching education at the EHF, he told me, it will be a dramatic change and it will be very interesting. And then it kept me thinking, okay, changes in hardware and changes in rules have changed the way we play the sport. Mm-hmm. In the late 70s, we started with artificial pitches, and it was a massive change for better and for good. Mm-hmm. And then the sticks started to be with the hook went shorter. The sticks became stiffer. Remember
carbon.
That? No. It, some years ago, they were putting rubber bands in the stick. And right now we put 95% carbon, which is hard like stone, carbon actually. And the ball became from the leather sewed ball to the mold injected plastic ball. And that was predictable. And the game, you know, exploded in terms of technique and skills. That was massive.
Yes.
The other changes that were the rules changes of the 90s, which is no offside, rolling changes, and shielding the ball with the body, that created a completely different sport as well. So, it will change, but we will adapt. And the game will keep on growing. I don't see it as a threat. Mm-hmm. If we do it, we will do it for the reasons that we will do it, which is sustainability, less use of water, you know. But the game, I think it will adapt. We have done it before. We can do it now.
Yes. Okay. So for you, it is 2026 and we go and we change?
That will depend on the manufacturers, of course. If the manufacturers have consolidated and in one group, you have three of the big supplier turf suppliers that you would have 25 years ago. Now they're in the same group. They cease to compete between each other. So the quality goes down, and the R&D expenses, because they are all belonging to private equity funds. So if they can cut R&D costs all at the same time, it's in their interest. And that's why we have not seen great pitches lately. Sure. I mean, compared with the one 20 years ago.
Yes.
It was. So it is very smart from the FIH to put a deadline and start the clock for R&D investments. I think that's a great move. I would have done the same.
Cool. Our probably best product of all time, at least from recent memory of in hockey, is the EHL. The European Hockey League has created some amazing hockey, amazing memories, amazing events, and has really lifted the profile of the game of hockey around the world even. But EHL, it's a club-based competition, so that means that it is in competition with the international calendar. That is a challenge in itself. The EHL has had a amazing sponsor with one of the Dutch banks closely tied to hockey. But yeah, sponsors don't go on forever and ever. Some have really long relationships with the sports they are interested in, and for a rightful reason, for the correct reasons. But the challenges are there financially and calendar-wise for EHL. So how do we secure that, we don't lose this amazing event?
Yeah, EHL, you remember when EHL started in 2007, first of all, it was the substitute of an already fantastic competition, which was the European Cup of Champions, right?
Yes.
Where Uhlenhorst and Blumenthal and Athletic de Terrassa and Reading would basically do great. And the innovations that EHL brought at the beginning were mind-blowing.
Yes.
The innovation with the TV production was absolutely fantastic. Mm-hmm. Instead of putting a camera in the middle, they would put the camera in the cameras in the 25
corners. Yes.
All the cameras inside the goals, and be the first ones to review and to do the video umpire.
Yes.
Far before football did.
They brought us self-pass. They brought us a lot of rule changes. Some good, some not so good.
Yeah, there was a great competition to do some trial and error on the rules, and that was great. And let's not forget that the first edition, it was fully paid by the organization.
Yes.
The clubs didn't put any money.
I remember well.
Right now, the club has to pay everything of their cost, and the winner gets a prize money of 10,000 euros, which I don't think that
doesn't cover the cost.
That changes anything. I mean, this is the good thing about the EHL is that we compete for the cup and for the honor and for the victory, not for the money.
Yes.
That's fantastic about it. So, but yes, I agree with you that lately the EHL has been sort of stagnated. And that is why the EHL board, where the EHF is a stakeholder in there, shareholder, by the way, there was an attempt to revamp the competition, to change the format, to bring in new capital and things like that, right? Actually, when I joined the board, the process had already started, but it was basically steered by the EHL, not that much of the EHF, but we were somehow involved. And then there are two forces that get together in this. The one is the people that have an opinion that we should change the format and stretch the format, because right now we have an event in October and then we forget about it and then we come back in Easter. So there's a lot of time between the two events and nothing happens. Mm-hmm. So say, okay, let's stretch the entire thing, but stretching the thing, it's a lot of cost in production. If you want to do all the competition with the same level of production, it's going to cost a lot of money. who covers this cost. Then you will have teams. I mean, there was the talks that we had. Okay, a team on a Tuesday, you go to Antwerp, play one game, come back. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's okay. In football, they do it, and that was the attempt to do that. But finally, the project didn't come through, and so on. There's another force, another opinion that says, no, let's not stretch it. Let's concentrate it. Let's do a super duper event in Easter. Not only 5 days, maybe 8 days. Yes, maybe we have not so many teams, but we have like 16 teams. We play 5 games, 7 or 8 days, and we are all there. We organize a lot of side events. We have the under 14 EHL. The Eco guys are doing under 19. They're thinking to do under 17. We could do EHL for plus 50 or masters, or we have as well an ID, you know, to bring a lot of people around the event, at least to secure the ticketing, right? And to do a super European club hockey party. That would be fantastic. Mm-hmm. But that does not, let's say,
solve all the issues.
Solve all the issues, right? Mm-hmm. But at least if you concentrate resources, you can save costs of production and so on. So we have these two things. How to address that? We have to have a broader conversation, and not just, you know, sometimes in hockey, as we are an amateur sport, there's what I call the pitch side conversation and then the office conversation. We have to have more office conversations with EHL, not just, you know, having a beer saying, oh, I think that the EHL should be this or that. But for sure, either we stretch it and we see if we can make a longer narrative, commercial narrative, or we concentrate it and we create a super duper event that can be as well very profitable.
Absolutely.
And very exciting and all together there and so on. Of course, this would, let's say, limit the number of places we can go. But at the end, the last 3 years we have been in Amstelveen, and Amstelveen is a fantastic place. The Wagener Stadium is great. And you have 12 more pitches at 500 meters, a 10-minute walk distance.
Yeah, so it offers a lot of possibilities, obviously.
And the current sponsor that likes to invite their clients there. So
I can imagine. I can imagine. As a last question, because we've been talking for over an hour already now, but maybe a very important question, because that was the reason for this talk. The presidential election is coming up. It's the national associations who elect the next president of the EHF. Why should the NAs choose Marcus Hoffman to be their next president at the EHF?
Well, hopefully this hour of conversation, I don't know if you're going to nip and tuck it, but it should be the first sign. But okay, let's, what can I add to this party? In sports management, as we were talking before, there are two different, let's say, schools of thought. The ones that say that the typical all-time hockey guys like me, or like, you know, even Peter or Marike or Leandro Negre or Tayab, and so the guys that have been involved in hockey all their life. And that's one set of people that manage hockey. And then you have the sport professionals, usually coming from the sports marketing, you know, thinking about always the demand economics, usually never supply economics. But that's the two forces. And then in Lausanne, in the big federations, you find it. I think that due to my professional life, my education, and my way of looking at organizations, I have this nerdy hockey thing all the time, very much interested in hockey. But I have as well the investment banking, private equity, venture capitalist mindset, which basically prevent me to fall for very nice PowerPoint presentations and Excel spreadsheets.
Yes.
And just as an example, when I saw the first time I saw the business plan for the Pro League, and I tell you, Leandro Negre is a very good friend of mine. His son was best friend at my wedding. And I told him, you are flat over your mind. It's going to happen this and this. And then he said, no, but we are in the middle of a sort of war inside the FIA. And we have to bring this forward. We have to change the World League for that. It's a demand of blah, 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 blah. And then hopefully he does not listen to this. I have been preventing myself from telling him, I told you so. No. And then, you know, I really like people around hockey. And I think I have an obsession of managing organizations and delivering results and engaging in projects and having as well the critical thinking to engage in a project, to engage in a process, and if it doesn't work, to say, okay, we cut it down. Mm-hmm. I give you an example. The penalty corner review process.
Yes.
That's the typical, and it's diagnosed. I mean, if anyone gets offended for that, go and read, you know, Nobel laureates, Danny Kahneman or Richard Thaler, that have pioneered behavioral economics and behavioral finance and organizational behavior. When an organization starts a process, it is very difficult to stop it. Yes. Because people are committed to the process, not to the purpose, to the original purpose. Mm-hmm. So you start the process, you start, and then you do this big survey, and you do meetings and committees and task force and working groups, and you have to deliver something, because not delivering something, it's like a failure. That happens, for example, in mergers and acquisitions, especially in corporate mergers and acquisitions. When General Electric wanted to buy Westinghouse, or when Daimler wanted to merge with Chrysler, or when Credit Suisse, we bought Donaldson, Lufkin and Jindrette in the early 2000s. The process starts and nobody has the courage to say enough.
Yes.
Because there's no accountability. Mm-hmm. If you look at venture capitalists or private equity firms, they say no most of the time because they have a vested interest and they get paid by their economic and financial success. So they have an incentive. In human organizations, the processes are very dangerous because they create confirmation traps. So you're looking always for information that corroborates your original hypothesis and irrational escalation of commitment. Mm-hmm. Once you tell to the world that you're reviewing that, if afterwards, imagine that Tayyip Ikram goes in a press conference, and guys, after 1.5 years of review of the penalty corner,
nothing changes. That
we're okay. Everybody would say, why are you doing that? Sorry. Yeah. That, I would say, here, Tayyip, that is a great decision. If you haven't found a reason to change it, even after 1.5 years of spending money, you don't change. That's leadership. That's good governance. Mm-hmm. The other is just, but it's human nature, right? It's not that something is more stupid than the other. Human nature. Happened to Jack Welch, the CEO of General Electric, who was at that time perceived to be the best CEO in the world. So don't worry.
No, absolutely. We all make our mistakes and our fair share of it probably as well. Okay, Marcus, it was a lovely time talking to you. Like I said, we've gone over the hour mark here. And
Now you can take the scissors and start to.
Yeah, but I want to avoid doing a lot of work myself as well. I prefer to just launch it as is here.
Sorry, I usually get into too many details, or I go from top down to details. And thanks God we have not got stuck in who was the best player in the world. That we could have a big program.
Yes, I don't think my servers are big enough to store all the memory from the video file for that conversation. but maybe the final one. Did I forget to ask you anything? Or have we covered most of what you want to talk about?
Yes, I... enlarging the Euro competition, that poses some, you know, problems. But if anyone wants to know why a 12-team Euro Nations Cup is at this moment very difficult, it's just basically because if we go to 12 teams, that moves a five-game, seven, eight days competition to a seven-game, 12 days competition. If you do it equally amazingly and you do 12 and 12 men and women, you need two pitchers. If you need two pitchers, you need two production teams. If you have two production teams and you have more 4 days, the cost skyrockets. And then you have to do it always in Northern Europe. Because if you go back down to Spain or Rome or so in summer, the right now, the mid part of the day, you can't play.
No,
you can't play. So, yeah, that's going to be, I know that there's a demand for that, and I don't, that the teams rank from 8 to 16 would love to see that. But if anyone has an idea of how to do it without bankrupting the federation, I quit the race and I will campaign for that.
Perfect, perfect.
Because that would be a cheat.
I already always, to these kinds of questions, I always have a not so friendly answer. We are a competitive sport. Competitive sport is merit-based. If you want to be in a top event, you have to earn your spot. And there are ways to make it to the top.
And with the current competition structure, you can do it pretty quick. For example, Russia and Ukraine and Belarus are not playing now. When they come back, in 4 years, they can be European champions.
It's a possibility.
Or depending on if they, you know, actually in 1.5 years, it's easier for them now. Before you would fall into championship four, then 3-2-1.
Yeah.
And that was a 6 year wait. Now it's, you can do it like that.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, Marcus, thanks very much for your time here.
And don't ask me, the best question you should have asked, why do you think Peter would be a good president?
I will ask Peter that question.
He'll card you. He's an umpire. So he's like, okay. Oh, sorry, yellow card. Now, first of all, Peter and I are not friends. We are very good friends.
Ah, cool. Yeah.
And whatever happens, surely after a period of mourning and so on, we will do great things for European hockey together. Who's going to end up on top? That's for the General Assembly to decide. But we've made a great team at the Development Committee, and we will keep on doing it with one of us as president. That's for sure. We love hockey too much to get annoyed by these things.
Absolutely. And there's room for a lot of people doing their things to promote our game of hockey. So again, Marcus, thank you very much for your time here. Thank you very much for your commitment to the game of hockey. And like we say before every game, may the best man win.
Yes. And I'm really happy that you didn't quit doing what you do. I know you had a spiritual crisis, but I'm so happy that you're back. We need you as well.
Yes, but I will refrain from some discussions because I think that those discussions are a lost game. So, but
put it this way. I mean, come on. I mean, you are very interested in the club structure. And when is the last time or the first time or any time that you can elect a club president who has founded a club association as president of the DHF? I say no more.
There we go. Thanks very much, Marcus. Talk soon. And we'll see each other for sure in Mönchengladbach.
Thank you very much, and bye.
Bye.